Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's March the 7th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I think we'll let Mac kick it off this week.
Hey, guys, this is Mac up in the Great White North. I just wanted to touch base with you and talk about excuses. Andy Donner was on here a little while ago and talked about his experience moving up here. He set up a plan, and he worked towards a goal. When I migrated, I was not aware of the Northwest migration. My choice was to just move up here because of the job opportunities. So I see a lot of people making excuses about, oh, I've got a contract, or I've got a job, or I've got a school, or I've got whatever. Or they complain about gun laws, or they complain about, we have volcanoes. Recently, a house was just swallowed up in Florida by a sinkhole. So those kinds of excuses are dumb. The Northwest has probably the largest block of states with the best gun laws there are. Recently, we've seen the tragedies at Sandy Hook and other places in many states, such as New York and Colorado, have seriously locked down their gun regulations and infringed on our rights to be able to defend ourselves. Not so in the Northwest. Montana, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, we have some of the best gun laws and support from our local law enforcement in the entire country. California, New York, Massachusetts, Illinois, they have such draconian gun laws that it's extremely difficult to get one. And then once you do get a firearm, you're not allowed to really use it for self-defense. In the Northwest, we get to openly carry loaded firearms on us so long as we are not criminals. In Oregon, Idaho, and Washington, or in Oregon, Idaho, and Montana, you can own just about anything so long as you can legally pass the background checks and get your permits. Washington, we aren't allowed to have short-barreled rifle, short-barreled shotgun, or full auto, but we can carry any handgun as long as you're, again, not a criminal. You can carry it pretty much anywhere. So I don't understand why all the excuses. As I said, when I moved up here, I moved up pretty much because I wanted to pursue the aviation industry. And when it came time to make the decision, I, unlike Andy, did not sit down and map out a plan and take little steps of finding a house, finding a job. I threw some applications out there, and I had a couple of interviews over the phone with a few different companies. But the end result was, when it came time to move, I just did it. I have the balls, I sucked up my courage, and I moved. In the end, that's, you just have to do it. So get off your butts. Get away from the heavy liberal taxations and gun laws of your state that you're in, if you're in one of these really bad states, and move up here. You'll find that it's a lot easier to live up here. And yeah, the area is much wider than many other states in the country. cities are cities. They are going to attract the detritus of society. But with perseverance and courage, you'll find a place that you fit in. You'll be happy here. And I don't see why the delays. So knock off the excuses and get your butts out here. We're getting more people in every day, and that's great, but we still need more. So come on up to the Northwest and join us.
Right. A few leftover bits and pieces from last week I need to clean up. First off, the comrade from the UK who wrote to me because he was pissed off by my comments about young white males living in their mother's basements was named John, not James, and he's contacted me again as follows. Thanks for the reply, Harold. Just to clear up who would pay me $3 an hour at Poundland. Okay, for those of you who are not as Brit aware as you might be, by the way, Poundland, from what I can tell on the internet, seems to be some kind of big box store similar to Walmart over here. I didn't know what it was at first because I didn't have it when I was last in the UK. Okay, getting back to John's email. Poundland would not pay me my $3 an hour. The taxpayer would pay me my $3 an hour. In the UK, people on unemployment benefit are now ordered by the government to work for their benefits in jobs which, were they working off benefits, would pay them at least three times as much. Yes, Britain has a minimum wage of £6.19 per hour, which, depending on the exchange rate this week, works out to about $10 an hour, but it doesn't apply to people working for government unemployment benefit, only for official employees. Okay, so this is one of those rackets whereby private enterprise and social democracy team up to force people into wage slave labor, which is, of course, what social democracy is supposed to be saving people from. But hell, a red is a red. Working at this Poundland place for £3 per hour may not be the gulag, but the principle is the same. Socialism needs cheap labor just as badly as capitalism does. Yeah, sorry, I'm rambling again. Let's get back to John. Because I'm not a single mother, disabled, or an asylum seeker, I'd be looking at getting roughly $3 an hour in unemployment benefit paid for by the taxpayer only for working for Poundland or some other such place for free. Otherwise, they'd cut off my unemployment benefit and I'd end up sleeping under a bridge. On top of that, my widowed mother would be legally forced to pay a special tax for me not living in her basement. Signed, John. John, tell you what. If you'll contact me and give me permission to release your email address, we'll see if there's any possibility at all of getting you over here to the homeland legally. I'm sorry, mate, that's all we can do. I've often wondered why the Brits don't resist, even more than I wonder why we here in America don't resist, but we won't get into that. Anyway, let me hear from you. Okay, news from the dictatorship. America has now taken one more step toward the third world. Criticizing a judge is now an imprisonable offense. Our dictator's servants must be allowed to retain their dignity. A Fox News reports, and I quote, "A group of free speech advocates is rallying behind an Indiana inmate serving 2 years for his online rants against a judge who took away his child custody rights during a divorce case." Okay, I'll summarize this here. Well, the first thing we need to note, and this is very important, there is not even a pretense this time on the part of the dictatorship that this man, whose name is Daniel Brewington, even so much as threatened anybody. Not the judge or anybody else. The excuse they used to drag Bill White into the machine was that he was allegedly threatening people on the internet, which he wasn't, but that was what they claimed. In this case, which I hadn't even heard of until a few days ago, they don't even claim this Brewington was making threats, as in actual threats of physical violence. His crime was that he openly disrespected an official who wears Obama's black robe and protested in public against the fact that this judge did him a terrible injustice. We're supposed to be able to do that in America, but, well, that was back in the old days before we became so enlightened. And we realized that we really don't need this piece of paper from the 18th century. That's another unwritten rule of this or any other dictatorship. When you draw the short straw and your time comes to do something horrible or suffer something horrible at the hands of the regime, you are expected to suffer in silence. You are not only expected to eat Obama's shit, you are expected to grin while you do it and then hold out your bowl and say, "Please, sir, may I have some more?" Now, for his refusal to suffer in silence, Daniel Brewington got 2 years in prison. Brewington was convicted in 2011 of intimidating a judge and attempting to obstruct justice. The Indiana Attorney General's office argued that his alleged threat was to expose the judge to, and I quote, hatred, contempt, disgrace, or ridicule. It sounds to me like he had it coming. Every time I hear the term contempt of court, I always think if the court does not wish to be held in contempt, then the court should refrain from behaving in a contemptible manner. No threats, remember, but apparently to state one's intention to criticize a public official on the internet is now legally considered to be a threat. Bloody wonderful. I won't keep on reading out the Fox article, but the sum total is that nowadays even speaking disrespectfully of one of these political gangsters in black robes constitutes quote-unquote felony intimidation. Oops, did I just commit a felony? So, what's next? Is speaking disrespectfully about the dictator himself a felony now? I'm not joking. That was one of Hugo Chavez's first laws that he decreed when he took over in Venezuela, and he would seize whole TV stations that criticized him. Obama hasn't quite admitted yet that he's modeling himself on Stalin, but he has an awful lot of kind words to say about Chavez. Oh, wait, here's some more from Fox News about this case that's interesting. Quote, the court will decide, after the March 11th filing deadline, on whether to take up the case. The government argued to the appeals court that some of Brewington's claims against the judge were false. It also argued their truthfulness was not necessarily relevant to prosecution because the harm, which in this case was striking fear into the victim, occurred whether the publicized conduct is true or false, blah, 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 blah. Okay, basically, truth is now no longer a defense. The Holocaust principle is now being extended to mundane criticism of the dictatorship's servants. And by the way, the horrible and intimidating words that got Mr. Brewington sent down for 2 years were, he called the judge corrupt and a child abuser for taking their father away from his children. This was a divorce case, remember. Brewington's real crime was apparently to get on the internet and present his side of the divorce case, which he was not allowed to present in court. Now, why does the name Edgar Steele keep floating through my mind here? Yeah, well, good luck, Dan, but you're on the wrong side of history. The slow-coming dark is descending much more rapidly now, and it is far more important that the humble servants of the One be protected from annoying and disrespectful language than to maintain some 230-year-old piece of paper. Ugh. Okay, let's see what else is going on. The conclave in Rome is coming up to elect the new pope after Joseph Ratzinger, a.k.a. Benedict XVI, finally had enough and chucked it in. The world left-wing media and establishment is pushing for the first black pope, apparently some Nigerian cardinal. I've seen a picture of him. He quite literally looks like a baboon. And, of course, in order to facilitate this or in some way try to intimidate the cardinals into electing this nigger as pope, the media is bringing out all kinds of sex stuff and this and that and the other thing. And they've managed to get two of the more conservative cardinals excluded from the conclave because of their alleged sexual peccadilloes. This Cardinal Mahony in Los Angeles was allegedly covering up for pedophile priests, and this guy O'Brien, who's the primate of Scotland. I didn't quite follow it all, and nobody else can, really, because it's one of those things. I mean, my God, who the hell knows what happened 30 years ago in something like that? Anyway, I am of two minds about this whole priestly buggery thing. I am sure that there are a number of Catholic priests who were abusing young boys down through the years, and I'm sure that there's a lot of that kind of thing throughout the whole church. Look, if you've got this big, huge institution that's bringing all kinds of single men together and forbidding them for their entire lives to have anything to do with women while providing them with jobs and careers, etc., etc., I mean, it's just natural you're going to get a lot of homos gravitating to that kind of situation. I do believe that a lot of this child molestation thing has been exaggerated, and that began when the church, in my opinion, very foolishly started paying out money for these accusations of things that allegedly happened 25, 30, 40 years ago, and nobody can prove one way or the other. Because then what happened immediately is the whole thing turned into a shakedown. Everybody and his kid brother was jumping up and yelling and screaming, yes, yes, 35 years ago, Father Tim diddled my digit in the vestry, blah, 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 blah. And it turned into, in essence, an extortion racket. I personally believe that John Paul II let that get out of hand. He should have dug in his heels and said, look, screw this. If you can prove that we did something wrong, fine, we'll let the law take its course. You can lock up the priests, whatever you have to do, but we're not paying out any money for this because we're not going to let you shake us down. But they didn't do that, and so the whole thing is now hopelessly clouded. And again, it's since all this stuff happened so long ago, I don't think anybody ever will be able to sort out what actually happened. But this is now being used as a form of pressure by the world liberal media, and I'm sure George Soros and other big knobs in the world leftist establishment are in there somewhere, in order to try and force the Vatican to elect a nigger pope. And in essence, change the whole nature of what the church is. By and large, I do consider the Roman Catholic Church to be one of the last remaining bulwarks of Western civilization. Many, many problems, though they have. And like I say, I've lived in Ireland back in the 80s when it was virtually a papal state. So I am aware of both the positive and the negative aspects of Roman Catholicism. It's interesting that supposedly the third prophecy of Fatima, the secret prophecy, was that this particular pope, number whatever it was, anyway, Benedict XVI, would be the last pope. So it could be that what the prophecy was saying was be the last white male pope before the church went the way of everybody else and started putting in niggers and women and nigger lesbian women and every other damn thing, like the Church of England has done, and so forth and so on. Anyway, I'm rambling here. I was working this up for the show, and I remembered this song from the 60s, which was considered very shocking at the time, about Catholicism. And bear in mind, this was back in the days when people were still capable of being shocked and genuinely offended. Believe it or not, there was a time when Roman Catholics were considered to be capable of being offended. Now, of course, the whole Roman Catholic Church is just a joke.
First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Do whatever steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff. Everybody say his own, Kyrie eleison, doing the Vatican right. Processional, step into that small confessional. They're the guy who's got religion. I'll tell you if your sin's original. If it is, try playing it safer. Drink the wine and chew the wafer. 2, 4, 6, 8. Time to transubstantiate. So get down upon your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Make a cross on your abdomen. When in Rome, do like a Roman. Ave Maria. Gee, it's good to see you. Getting ecstatic and sort of dramatic and doing the Vatican right.
Hi, this is Tom. Sometime around in July, I was interviewed by Harold Covington as a potential migrant, and I just wanted to come back on here and mention to you guys that I did in fact make the migration. It was quite a long trip, and it took an awful lot of work, but I followed a lot of Andy Donner's advice and took my time and carefully planned the entire trip. Basically, it was a success. I found work within 4 weeks of being here, probably a little bit less than that. You know, like I said before, it was very difficult, but it was very worth it. I was warned about the winters being somewhat like I'm not used to, which I made it through that just fine. It's really not a bad experience at all. I don't want to get into too much detail about the actual trip itself because, you know, for obvious reasons. If there's anybody who's kind of on the fence about what they need to be doing in order to make the migration, or if they're not even seriously considering it, I would recommend that you do it. There's really not a whole lot more that I can say about it except to follow Andy Donner's advice and come and do it for yourself, do it for your people, because nobody else is going to do it. My comrade who was here with me in July, he's planning on making his migration as soon as it's feasible for him, given his circumstances. And I look very much forward to that day, as well as meeting any of you guys who come up here. If there's anything that I can do as far as moving your stuff to help you out, if it's possible for me to do so, I'd be glad to. That's really about all I've got. I'm not a very interesting guy. It's like probably most of you guys feel like you're not. I'm not an intellectual marvel or anything like that. I'm just a guy trying to do the right thing. And if you're confused about what the right thing is, if you're listening to these podcasts, you're probably starting to gain an understanding of what the appropriate thing that you need to be doing is. So that said, I wish you the best of luck, and I hope to see you fellow comrades up here as soon as you can make your migration. Good luck to you, and Godspeed.
Good evening, comrades. You know, as Harold has said, you're more than welcome to make MP3s and submit them. The only caveat that, of course, I would have, and I'm sure that all of us involved with the NF would have, is that, of course, this is a serious show. And so if you're somebody who wishes to play games, then I would say you needn't submit any MP3s. But aside from that, if you are a serious listener who enjoys the show and wants to help out, you're really more than welcome. The weeks go by very quickly, and I'm always asking myself, what can I do for the next show? I'm always looking for something, and a couple of weeks ago, there was a comrade that sent me all of this information on Ozotro, Nordic religion, Germanic religion, so I've gotten a lot of grist for the mill out of that. I've been using it to the extent that I think I'll have to talk about something else soon. But there was so much there. I ended up reading the book Wotan's Volk recently. I read it online, and, you know, there's certain things that stand out to me, primarily Miguel Serrano and his insights. And he really has this idea of Wotan as a living god, as an actuality. It's really worth reading. It's, admittedly, I understand it's propaganda, and I don't see anything wrong with that, because I don't see anything wrong with calling some propaganda. In fact, there was even times in my life when I fantasized about being a propaganda writer, and I suppose I'm doing that in some respects on this show, doing propaganda. At any rate, I read that book, and it's enjoyable, and then after I read that, I looked into this great wealth of information that this comrade sent me, and I found this paper on Germanic religion. It was a very serious paper on this idea of religious reconstruction. The writer was saying that if you look into authentic Germanic religion before there was any synchronicity with Christianity, what you find is mainly a cult of the grave mound, where you would have ancestors that would be buried in the grave mounds, and you would live near the grave mound of your ancestors, and the ancestors would give you a certain amount of luck or fortune. They would sort of watch over your home. And this was basically the sum total, according to this author, Bill Lindsay. That was basically Germanic religion until you came to synchronicity with Christianity, and then you had this idea of the patron deity and this idea that your soul would go and be with the patron deity. And even though that's something that we talk about a great deal and we think about nowadays when we think of Ozotro, that's not really authentic. So that was, I suppose it was a very scholarly paper. But, of course, that concept of Germanic religion for today's world is not really very palatable anymore. because you may not be living near your ancestor's grave mound. You're probably not in most cases. Even if you are living near, say, a cemetery where some of your relatives are buried, they're probably people that were involved in Christianity in most cases. Yeah, everybody loves their grandma or something, their uncle or something, but we're not particularly inclined to deify these individuals, and they probably had, I suppose, nice lives. I suppose if they were in the military or something, you could say that they were heroic, but I'm sure many of our relatives are just sort of plain folk. You can't really aggrandize them terribly. So this concept, I guess, to the modern mind may not be all that fulfilling. Now, the author of this article does admit that a lot of people, even in Christianity up until recently, would have this idea that the soul would wait until Judgment Day. So there's kind of two ideas in Christianity. Some Christians will say you go to heaven right away, and some will say that you kind of wait in the grave until Judgment Day comes. But the author, nevertheless, is saying basically that dualism is a religious belief where you think the soul immediately leaves the body, and that non-dualism is a belief where you're kind of stuck in the grave, which is kind of an odd, I think, belief for most people in today's world. So I found that article very interesting, but I'm kind of left cold. You know, what would I do with that? What does that inspire? I had these two sort of contradictory views. One is Miguel Serrano, and then there's this Bill Lizzy, and they're telling me things that are very opposite. So then I started thinking about when I first started to get somewhat interested in Ozotro and I was reading about it. The interesting thing that started happening to me is sometimes I'd go out and I'd take walks. One of the first things that I saw, and this wasn't a vision, this was something in the real world, I was out taking a walk and I noticed a squirrel that had one eye. I'm not kidding. And I would sometimes see, like, one time I saw an older man who was wearing an eye patch, and I mean, he was a real person. He was just an old guy. He had a cataract operation or something. So just having those kinds of experiences that were just sort of unusual coincidences that didn't really feel like coincidences, that kind of make me side more with Serrano than with Lizzy. Then I was watching that show on the History Channel about the Vikings, and it was talking about Ragnar and how he wanted to go out and sail west, and it showed him having visions, and it was kind of portraying what Lizzy was talking about as a non-dualism, although I don't know if I'd exactly call it non-dualism, because there's actually a scene in that show, if you watch the first episode, where a body is actually taken up by Odin. He kind of just swoops down and takes the body of the warrior. So that's kind of, in some sense, it's a non-dualism, because he's sort of physically would appear sort of just taken. Those are sort of my thoughts on various things, and I know that's sort of a smattering of different ideas, but sometimes I feel like I don't have enough from one article or one book that really works for the show, so I have to put something together, and I hope that doesn't come across as too much rambling and so forth, but I would say again, there are so few people that have been contributing to this show, and do I like being on the show? Yes, I very much like being on the show. Am I a bit of a ham? Perhaps. Clearly I've been on a great deal, but I feel that I must help out. I must pick up the slack on this very important show. So I look for things. I mean, this weekend I was watching The Producers, which is a movie that is kind of a satire, a heckle, and so forth. And, you know, it's so typical of Hollywood films. Of course, this is a film that's been around since the late 60s, but if you're someone like us, all your role models end up being sort of the buffoons. So I always find myself in this place between exhaustion and functionality, in a place between, well, I need to function, but I'm also an idealist. So then I end up in a place where I'm always resisting, but then I get exhausted, you know, and sometimes I think to myself, when it comes to this show, sometimes I think to myself, if anybody needs a Hawaiian vacation, it's me. I love being on this show and helping out. Okay, but you're welcome to help out too. So thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed my little talk.
If I might interject here, every now and then I get emails from listeners asking me, in effect, why I have Gretchen on here every week talking about boring books that most people will never read, and why I don't quit playing all this pointy-headed Irish and medieval stuff and play only white skinhead rock, maybe a few satanic vibes thrown in, that kind of thing. And no kidding, a lot of the same people who claim to find Gretchen boring and incomprehensible seem to be the ones who only want to hear loud clanging guitars, because, of course, that's what they've been conditioned to listen to in the American pop culture in which they grew up. And that's one of the reasons I have people like Gretchen on, and also why I play something besides endless Ian Stewart. White people need to understand that there is not only something else other than what they've been shown all their lives by the Jews, but that what they have been shown is wrong. Now, Ronald Reagan once said that the trouble with liberals is not that they're ignorant, but that they know so much that isn't so. In a way, it's the same with white people. It's not so much that you're stupid, it's just that you've never been shown everything there is to see. You've never been taught everything there is to know about your own heritage and yourselves. Now, again, let me be very clear here. I'm not mocking or running down these people. They can't help being the way they are. The Jews made them that way, and somehow we're going to have to find a way to get through to their skulls full of mush and try somehow to reassemble their brains, which have been pureed in the Jewish blender. And you know, despite my constant haranguing and shouting and cursing at you all and telling you to pull your socks up and get your ass out here, I think we actually have very few truly bad people listening to this show. Those who do have been bad from the beginning, Jews, SPLC, FBI spies, so forth and so on. White Americans as a whole, and most movement types as well, are not bad people. They're just confused and damaged and rudderless, and they've been socially engineered into a lot of really bad habits, like laziness and feeling rather than thinking. Now, the party needs to do what we can to try and get you out of those bad habits, hence Gretchen and hence my odd musical selections. Now, let me tell you one of my Grandpa Simpson stories from the days of yore. Bear with me, this does have a point. Now, some of you listening to this may remember a man named Jesse B. Stoner, who was for many years associated with Dr. Edward Fields of the National States Rights Party and the Thunderbolt newspaper, which name was later changed to The Truth at Last. Now, J.B. was quite a well-known character in the old movement. He and Ed Fields had the kind of relationship I need to develop with that certain somebody who becomes our much sought-after national organizer. Dr. Ed was the newspaper editor and writer and the ideological and spiritual leader of the NSRP, and J.B. was the people person who went around doing all the media appearances and public PR and propaganda, so forth and so on. Anyway, one of J.B.'s regular propaganda ploys was running for political office in his home state of Georgia. Now, this was back in 1970, if memory serves, and J.B. was running for governor of Georgia in the Democratic primary, since in those days most whites in the South were still registered Democrat. Now, this was in the days before the internet, of course, and the main medium of communication for politics was television. Mostly live television, since even videotape was still in its early days back then. Now, some big liberal TV station in Atlanta had offered all the candidates for governor in the primaries 5 minutes of live airtime to persuade the voters, and after some discussion they decided they couldn't exclude J.B. Stoner, since he'd run before and he'd come up with a solid 10 or 12% of the vote. But J.B. was well known as an old-time segregationist and a Klansman and whatnot, and the liberals who ran the station were very nervous about having him on for fear that he might say rude and crude and horrible things about race, which would be all the worse because everyone watching would know it was true. Now, these days, of course, that situation wouldn't even arise. A legitimate white nationalist wouldn't be allowed anywhere near a live mic in an actual political program. But this was 43 years ago, before the dictatorship, when the country was a lot more civil and free, and there was still some sense of fair play in our national life. So, when J.B. showed up at the television station for the debate, the station manager took him aside and says, Mr. Stoner, you know, it's our policy to offer this free airtime to all the candidates in the primary, but we have to ask that you moderate your language when you're on the air, since this is going out live, and please don't say that horrible, wicked, naughty word. And J.B. played dumb and says, well, I don't understand. What word are you talking about? And the station manager leans over and whispers, you know, that word, it begins with N. And J.B. says, oh, okay, that word. Yeah, I get you. That's fine. I certainly don't need to use that word to make my point to the voters, so don't worry about it. I promise I won't speak any forbidden syllables on the air. And the liberal station manager says, oh, thank heavens, Mr. Stoner. I'm just so glad to hear you say that. We were so concerned that you might say something that might offend somebody. Blah, 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 blah. You get the idea. So, they go into the studio, and all the candidates sit down at a long table, and there's a podium up front with a microphone and all the cameras trained on it, and each candidate in the primary election gets up and gives his 5-minute campaign speech. They save JB for last, and he gets up to the podium, and he straightens his tie, and JB looks into the camera at all the 200,000 or so viewers in the greater Atlanta area, and in a loud, clear voice, he says, nigger, 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 nigger. True story. Okay, that kind of thing is funny sometimes. I'm tempted to do it on the Mike Harris show sometimes, although I better shut up about that or Mike won't have me on anymore. But things are getting sufficiently serious and dangerous so that we've got less and less time for playing pranks. Now, believe me, in the unlikely event that I were ever offered 5 minutes of live airtime on a worldwide network like Fox or CNN, I'd make a lot better use of the opportunity than to just holler nigger. Yeah, I know, I use the N-word and the F-word and the J-word for reasons I've explained. If you guys don't get it, I'll go through my George Orwell 1984 Newspeak Control of Thought Through Control of Language rap again. Glad to, because that's one that you guys really, really need to get your arms around. But that's why I have Gretchen on, and that's why I try to educate you people in what it means to be an Aryan. Why I try to show you in music what you're giving up when you trade your racial heritage for America's Ronald McDonald and South Park and clanging electrical guitars. I'm trying to show you and everybody listening that there is more to the NF than just shouting nigger, nigger, nigger. Okay, next music break. You know, just because something doesn't consist of clanging electrical guitars and screamed lyrics one can barely understand, that doesn't mean it has to be pointy-headed. You know, us white boys have a whole vast musical heritage that's gloriously lowbrow. This is the world-famous Cajun fiddler Doug Kershaw.
A big man when he holds a pretty woman's hand. Who is the bigger, he or me? Just because I don't come from the city, no, I'm a swamp rat, I'm not a city cat. But who gives a hang about a city cat? Cause I get more loving than the law will allow, sitting out back on my room shack. Thank you.
Okay, time now for the main tirade of the week. Now, a few days ago, I sent out a warning email to let our people know that our friends in the silk suits have been sleazing around the Northwest again in their black SUVs. Nothing specific, no bionic backpacker JT Reddy incident this time. No actual investigation of anything, just routine fishing around, trying to get people to talk to them, trying to develop informers and sources of information. Now, most likely, these visits are just what we call budget burners. Now, these people are spending taxpayer money in copious amounts, and they have to file weekly or monthly reports on how they're spending it. Now, you can spend a lot of money driving around to little obscure places all over the Pacific Northwest to interview people whose name you've picked up from monitored email or text as being a possible dissident, and who by some wild stretch can be used to justify the time and gas and meal allowance and so forth, and burn some of that budget before the end of the fiscal quarter. This time, though, there are a couple of interesting new twists. It's apparent that the droids have been listening to my Radio Free Northwest podcasts because they're now looking to find out if anybody's going to be doing any leafleting, which is something I talked about a few weeks ago on here. And even weirder, they're now looking for the NVA. Yes, their words. They want to find out who's in the NVA. The fact that the NVA is a fictional organization and does not exist, either hasn't registered with them yet after 9 years, or else there is a more sinister possibility, which is that the United States government or one of its secret police agencies has decided for their own purposes to bring the NVA into existence. And you know, there's all kinds of precedents for that. I, for one, have never been completely convinced that Al-Qaeda actually exists, at least not as advertised. Or if it does, I've always thought it was probably one of these outfits founded by the CIA that just got out of hand. It's common knowledge that Osama bin Laden got his start and his first military training in Afghanistan through one of the CIA's many front groups, which were set up to resist the Russians. You know, that's how Hamas in Gaza and Palestine came into existence, right? It was founded in 1988 as a front for Israeli intelligence during the time of the First Intifada, because some bright spark in the Mossad decided that Islamic fundamentalism could be used as a political counterweight to the secularist PLO. Well, we all know how well that turned out. I know of another, more minor case of this kind of thing happening, and that was one that I was personally involved in. Now, you remember the fabled Combat 18 group in Great Britain? It first started getting publicity in the Jew Jerry Gable's idiotic Searchlight magazine back in the early 1990s, but at that time there was no such thing as Combat 18. That's right. For the first year or so of its ostensible existence, there was no Combat 18 outside the pages of Searchlight. Jerry Gable made it up. Because always remember, without Nazis, there can't be anti-Nazis. Then what happened was some lads from the Chelsea football hooligans read about Combat 18 in Searchlight, and they decided that if there was no Combat 18, then there bloody well should be. And they started raising a bit of ruckus off the terraces, punching Jamaican cab drivers, playing with matches, doing some spray painting, etc., etc., and leaving behind calling cards or graffiti marked C-18. Lo and behold, all of a sudden, the real Combat 18 was born. There never would have been any Combat 18 if Jerry Gable hadn't decided his magazine was running short of allegedly violent white racists whose activities he needed to quote-unquote monitor and expose so he could raise funds and continue to make a living. Now, this may be what's happening with the latest round of visits by the so-called Joint Terrorism Task Force. They may have decided that if there is no NVA, then there should be, for their purposes. I think they've heard my comments on the Northwest Volunteers over the past few podcasts, which don't exist either, by the way, and quite possibly will never exist. And either they simply don't understand what I'm saying, which is quite likely since secret policemen aren't exactly known for being quick on the uptake, or else, and this is the more sinister alternative, which we do have to take into account, they've decided that since the NVA does not exist outside the pages of my novels, they're going to have to make one up and use the activities of this fabricated NVA to justify their own existence. Okay, before I can discuss that possibility further, you guys need a little background. Most of the visits that our people are getting come from a goomer called the Joint Terrorism Task Force. I used to think this was one of those many arms of the octopus that leaped into being and started lashing out after 9/11, but I looked it up and I found out that the JTTF actually goes back all the way to 1980. What the JTTF started out as was one of the many subtle ways that the United States government has developed to get around the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, which ended Reconstruction in the South, and which forbids U.S. troops from being deployed against American citizens for internal political control purposes, such as to back up corrupt state or city governments, which is what the United States Army was in fact being used for during Reconstruction. Now, contrary to popular belief, the Posse Comitatus Act does not prohibit all use of U.S. military forces against American citizens. But in order to do so, the president has to declare a certain region of the country in a state of insurrection, and he has to get the approval of Congress, which, of course, our present dictator would have no problem in doing, given that we're now a one-party state with no opposition party. However, for obvious reasons of propaganda and psychology, this is a last resort kind of thing that would really let the cat out of the bag that America isn't really the Cosby Show. What the regime has been doing for a long time, even before the present one-party dictatorship, in order to get around this law and establish what amounts to an internal political control army to be used against American citizens in case of rebellion against the dictatorship, is largely federalizing local law enforcement by bribing the local cops with money and toys to betray their own communities, whom they're supposed to be protecting and serving, and to obey orders from Washington, D.C. instead, when the rubber does finally hit the road in Obama's America. Now, this is why local police and sheriff's departments all over the country have been militarized by the federal government, loading them up with all kinds of black body armor and cool-looking black plastic full automatic weapons and armored cars and armored personnel carriers and black helicopters and gas and hazmat suits so they can dress up like spacemen and giving them all kinds of training at Quantico for their SWAT teams, so forth and so on. I mean, Jesus. Why does some little town of 10,000 people in rural Idaho need a SWAT team? But it all makes these country bumpkin cops feel big and bad like they're characters on a television show or in a movie, and of course there's all that lovely federal money that goes with it. Now that's the key in Obama's America. Always. Money, money, money. All that lovely money in the taxpayer's kitty. Who gets to spend it? Who gets how much of it? How is this biggest and juiciest of pies in history to be divided up, and who does the dividing? Somebody back in the 18th century once wrote that democracy ends when men discover they can vote themselves money from the public funds. Democracy ended in America a long time ago. Okay, I know I'm rambling again, so I need to get back on track. Joint Terrorism Task Force. I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. Basically, the FBI goes into certain police departments and signs what's called an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, and they essentially hire away X amount of cops and detectives from that department and make them part of a joint task force with FBI, ATF, and DHS agents, as well as who knows what, the odd Secret Service man or CIA spook, whatever. Now, if there's a crime problem in the city or community, and the ordinary people who live there really do need their local police to be dealing with that instead of chasing phantom terrorists for nigger attorney generals and bull dyke homeland security secretaries, then tough cheese. Who cares if ordinary people get carjacked or stabbed by crazy nigger junkies, so long as Barry and Michelle can sleep safe in the White House tonight? Now, this is where they start spreading around all that lovely federal money, and local police departments and cities jump at it like the dog in the TV ad howling for bacon-flavored begging strips. You need to understand that anti-terrorism in this country is a multi-billion dollar industry. It's the best paycheck you can get and the biggest bandwagon you can jump on. Anti-terrorism money is an endless flow of big, big bucks, and everybody in every state and local government around the country really wants a taste of that sweet stuff. Now, burn this into your brains, because it is the key to understanding so much of what is going on here. Without terrorists, there can be no anti-terrorists. Without terrorists, there can be no flow of millions of dollars in anti-terrorist money to these various law enforcement agencies. Therefore, it is vital that these agencies frequently discover and arrest terrorists of some kind. Any terrorists, whether they're real or not, it doesn't matter. And if the terrorists don't exist, the FBI and other secret police agencies will make them up. This may well be what happened in the notorious Edgar Steele case. I think it may be what happened in the Kevin Harpham bionic backpack case. The FBI now admits that they have fabricated evidence and suborned perjury in a number of so-called terrorism cases against hapless Muslim kids who were set up from the get-go with phony inert car bombs and suicide vests by FBI agents and informants. They've admitted this in court, that they set the whole thing up, and the judge banged his gavel and sentenced the poor dumb brown bastard to 25 years anyway. It's not just disgraceful, it's stunning. I have to admit, I never thought it would get this bad in America. I don't know, I guess I was just hopelessly naive. But anyway, I'm sorry, babbling again. Yes, it's entirely within the bounds of possibility that the Federal Bureau of Investigation may have decided to fabricate a so-called Northwest Volunteer Army, a possibility that I will discuss later on in this podcast. Now, the FBI and or DHS pay the police or sheriff's department for their officers' time devoted to Joint Terrorism Task Force work. They pay the local cops themselves, so all of a sudden you've got some detective with kids and a heavy mortgage, or heavy alimony, or both, who's pulling down two paychecks, and so you know he's on board with whatever his new bosses tell him to do. Now, sometimes they will make him a U.S. Marshal on the side to give him federal jurisdiction as well as being a city cop or county mountie, whatever, and that's another paycheck, and it looks really great on a resume. And by this time, this local Barney Fife type is so enthralled with it all that he will do anything for his new paymasters. As in anything they ask. After all, money's good, right? That's how we judge people in America. If you have money, you're cool, and if you don't have any money, then you're a loser. Now, somebody who's paying Deputy Barney Fife $60,000 per year over and above his regular pay, so he's not a loser anymore, Just can't be evil sons of bitches without souls. Can they? The FBI loads the local police or sheriff's departments who have signed this memorandum of understanding up with all the toys that I've mentioned, the vehicles and the weapons and the black body armor so they look real cool like Nazi stormtroopers or maybe Star Wars stormtroopers. And yeah, I know, but you have to admit that the Third Reich was a cool look. Black uniforms project strength and power. The Germans had those alpine caps with those sharp bills and not our dorky round American baseball cap and the boots and all that leather, man. And no joke, everybody wants to wear those outfits, especially Jews in Hollywood, where Jewish actors line up for parts playing Germans in war movies so that they'll get to wear a Nazi uniform. Now, why do you think the U.S. military got rid of all those perfectly good steel pots and switched to a helmet shape that was as close to the old Nazi coal scuttle as they dared to go? Because that helmet just plain looks good. It's elegant. 70 years later, people are still fascinated with the whole Third Reich look. You don't believe me? Watch the first Starship Troopers movie and tell me what those uniforms look like. Sorry, Grandpa Simpson is wandering again. And where the hell was I? Okay, yeah. Joint Terrorism Task Force, yeah. Anyway, the local cops and detectives who are picked up by the JTTF become the point men, the eyes and the ears in their communities for the dictatorship's secret police. They start accumulating files on people in their communities who might hold dissenting views, and if they're in any doubt as to who those people are, they get these special training seminars and bulletins from the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League telling them exactly who to look for. Now, did you know, for example, that if you're found with a copy of the United States Constitution on your person, that marks you as a right-wing extremist who needs to be watched and maybe detained without trial in the event of a national emergency proclaimed by the One? Okay, I'm really rambling here. I'm starting to run long, so I'd better do third music break. I think I'll dedicate this to Andy Donner since he likes Carl Klang.
Communism is dead, they said. I think they lied, it's truth they hide. For still survives in the good old USA. Eh? Right here it lives and here it breathes and feeds upon our liberties. And you have the nerve to say it's not that way? Well, they're taking the patriots away. Ha ha, they're taking the patriots away.
shoots away, ho ho, hee hee ha ha, to the prison camp, where life's unbearable all the time, and I'll be happy to see my patriot friends again as they shackle me in, and they're taking the patriots away, ha ha! Here come Jack Boo, the thugs in black, to smash your doors and stomp your cat, to rouse you out in the late, late hours of the night. Wrong! At 3 a.m. they scream and shout and scatter your living room about. With threats of death they swear as they tear up your rugs. For guns! They're taking the patriots away, ha-ha. They're taking the patriots away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the prison camp, where life's unbearable all the time. And you shouldn't shoot back at those men in black with their ski masks on and their weapons drawn. Cause they're taking the patriots away, ha-ha. The twisting thread shall stretch and snap, the straw shall break the camel's back, and tables when they turn shall bring a swift end. Friend, yes, things divine can wrench and bend the well-laid plans of mice and men, and when they do, what will you traitors do then? When? We'll be taking the traitors away, ha-ha, we'll be taking the traitors away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the prison camps, where a cell's been awaiting them all this time, and I'll be happy to see their face in its proper space, filling jail space, as we're taking you traitors away, ha-ha. To the prison camps they've quietly built so recently, and won't they look cute in their prison suit, and their shackles on, just shuffling along, as we're taking the traitors away, ha-ha. Well, there's jobs for you in that human zoo, and you'll work all day without any pay. But that's okay, there's nothing to buy in there anyway, and we're taking you traitors away, ha-ha! And won't they do them as they see us come, to round up the rest of them one by one, as we're taking the traitors away, ha-ha!
Let me run down the basics here for everybody concerned. First off, to these people from the Joint Terrorism Task Force, no, there is no Northwest Volunteer Army. If you want to find it, I suggest you order any one of my 5 Northwest novels, either from Amazon.com or Lulu.com, and Bob's your uncle. But, of course, you already know the NVA doesn't exist, don't you? Unless, of course, you really are as dumb as a bag of hammers, which I suppose is possible, considering all the affirmative action and diversity in federal law enforcement hiring these days. Secondly, to our own people, I say the same thing. There is no Northwest Volunteer Army, and if anyone attempts to tell you different, get the hell away from them. Always bear in mind the cardinal rule of movement safety. If someone repeatedly attempts to get you to commit illegal acts, then he or she is either a dangerous idiot or a law enforcement officer of some kind. Either way, get away from them and stay away. If anyone repeatedly attempts to engage you in conversation about illegal acts and simply will not shut up about it, get away from them and stay away. But before you do, make sure that you say loudly and clearly, for the benefit of whatever microphone or recording device they may be wearing, something to the effect of, "No, we are not going to do that." The Asheville Six back in the 80s could have saved themselves many years in prison if someone had simply said out loud to Frank Braswell, where it could be picked up on Michael Sweat and Jill Arthur's tape recorders, "Frank, we are not going to do anything of the kind, so shut the hell up about it." Braswell went down for running his mouth, and the other 5 went down for keeping quiet. They figured, hey, that's just old Frank running his mouth again. He'd been babbling on like this for years until no one paid any attention to him anymore. Yeah, well, Frank's mouth ran himself and Milano Caudle into the grave, and everybody else into a prison cell they didn't need to have seen the inside of. Always remember what I keep telling you. The Northwest Front is a legal movement which has to act as if it were an illegal one, precisely because of the stupid crap like this mess that we're getting right now from the suits. It is none of their business where certain people are or what they are doing. Now, what we do, what we believe, what we say and write, where we are, and how we live are things that do not concern the FBI or any other government agency. No one is breaking any laws here, and the secret police agencies know it, as witness the fact that they're only coming 2 at a time to knock on our doors. Believe me, these people are sufficiently solicitous for their own skins so that if they had the slightest suspicion that we really were dangerous and violent criminal extremists, there would be a lot more than 2 of them and they wouldn't be knocking first. So they know damned well that there's nothing going on with us of any criminal nature. Which means that these visits are purely political and ideological harassment, or, as I said before, most likely just the JTTF burning up some budget they need to spend before the end of the quarter. Yeah, well, as far as I'm concerned, you guys can fritter away your excess allowance somewhere else. Go pester those Occupy Wall Street brats. They actually do things like vandalism and rioting. Oh yeah, that's right. They get a pass because they were part of the dictator's re-election campaign. Silly me. On one occasion, the Secret Service sent a single Astoria cop to my door first before the three of them showed up. And I pointed out to the officer that if I was in fact a bloodthirsty maniac with a house full of guns and explosives, the feds had just sent him in as a sacrificial lamb to spring the trap. And he laughed and said, yeah, the point had not escaped him. Now him I talked to briefly, just to let him know that, no, I wasn't a nut who was going to start shooting out my window at the passers-by. Now he was a local cop, and since he'd been told this by the same federal agents who were too afraid to come and see me without sending him in first, he had to check it out, and I got that. After he told the Secret Service that it was safe and they'd rocked up, I asked if they had a warrant. They didn't, and I closed the door in their face. Now that's what you should do, by the way. Now, I won't go over the five words again because I've done so at least a dozen times on this program. I will say that it's kind of like what I mentioned a few weeks ago regarding the kind of iron self-control and self-discipline it takes to close and delete a goo-boo email the second you realize what it is. You have to overcome what Dr. Pierce referred to as that unhealthy fascination with gossip and scandal and madness that afflicts all Americans and which seems to be hardwired into us now. Visits from our friends in the silk suits are the same. I get this. It can be unnerving and catch you off guard when all of a sudden you hear the knock, and there they are on the doorstep and they flip their badges, but there's also a fascination about it. It definitely breaks the boredom of a long and normal day. You feel kind of important all of a sudden, kind of at the center of things, now that you've received your first official visit with a capital V. You feel curious, too, as to why the hell they're on your doorstep. What do they want? Surely it'd be okay to probe a little, to try and find out what they want, play a few mind games with them. No, it isn't. But like I said, we're not Northwest Volunteers yet. We're not disciplined political soldiers, and most average American white people can't resist that temptation to play with the situation a little, just like some people can't resist the temptation to feed alligators. Maybe even come to think of them as pets until one day the gator leaps up out of the water and rips your leg off at the hip. Look, those people are not there on your doorstep out of any concern for you or your family. They are there to hurt somebody, and either it's you or they want your help to hurt someone you know. Under no circumstances whatsoever are they ever your friends. In some cases, they are quite literally killers. They are armed, and for the past year or so, since the dictator imposed the Dream Act on this country by imperial decree, and nothing was done about it, they have been above the law. Now, this is what I think we still don't quite grasp in this country. The dictator and his servants can now do anything they want to anyone, anytime, and nothing will be done about it. At some point, my guess is, fairly soon actually, we're going to have some kind of really nasty incident that will demonstrate this new fact of life. Look, people, when they show up at your door, you should give them only the five words. But like I said, I don't expect perfection yet. If you absolutely must say anything to them at all, just send them to me. I'll deal with them. I mean, after all, it's what you pay me the big bucks for. By deal with them, of course, I mean I'll close the door in their faces. And yes, it's true. On one occasion, a while back, I did violate this rule because there was something specific I wanted to find out from them. I wanted to find out whether or not they were seriously trying to implicate any of us in the Spokane backpack incident. They weren't. They were just fishing. And so I brought the interview to a close. But seriously, guys, don't try to deal with these people yourselves. Send them to me if they'll come, and I will close the door in their faces, okay? Now, these are bad people. They are dangerous, because if they should decide to fabricate a so-called Northwest Volunteer Army and commit some really vile and bloody black op in the name of the NVA as an excuse to round us all up and ban my books and so forth, then you and your family and your friends might be in the frame for that if you talk to them. There is nothing at all we can do about it if that's the case. They're going to do whatever they're going to do, and we have no say in the matter. Now, this is why we have to have a revolution in this country, because that very situation exists. Rule by presidential decree and completely uncontrolled and unaccountable state musclemen are the very things that the United States Constitution was written to prevent. But whereas, like I've already said, there's nothing criminal or violent going on with us, I didn't say we weren't dangerous. We are, and they know it. And that's why they keep showing up on our doorsteps to pick at us and see if they can find some thread that they can pull on to unravel us. We are dangerous to them because we are wielding the one weapon that they cannot outlaw or confiscate or register or avoid. An idea. The ideal of white freedom in a sovereign nation of our own, right here on this continent, where our forefathers meant for us to have that very thing. The dictator can decree gun control. He cannot impose idea control. And wherever the ideal of white freedom in a nation of our own goes, the gun will eventually follow. The Joint Terrorism Task Force can murder people. They cannot kill an idea. The Joint Terrorism Task Force can send anyone they want to prison forever, if they like, with perjury and fabricated evidence, but they cannot imprison an idea. They can lock away our bodies, but they cannot lock away the minds and the hearts of an entire race of people. And so long as the ideal of white freedom lives on in those minds and hearts, for all their guns and their handcuffs and their black robes and their orange jumpsuits, they're still losing. And I think some of them probably have sufficient instinct and intelligence to realize that they're losing. That's when people like the JTTF are at their most dangerous. When they finally understand that at some point in the future, they and the society and the order they serve will come crashing down into the dust. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.